what's the opposite of faith? Like, lack of it? Unbelief?
Atheism.
Right. So, faith and history. It's really faith versus history, but how? Why are we construing it that way? We're, in fact, accepting a construct that's been given to us by the world. Faith versus history. And we're going to talk today about whether we're going to accept that or not. Why are they counterposed like that? So I'm just giving you a question. It's not a rhetorical question, but because we've all been at the art fair or whatever in the sun, it's hard to remember why this would be important. Actually, it's a critically important question. And I would view today's discussion as very challenging to turn these ideas over. Any idea why? What can we expect? What's the problem? The problem is that Christian history presupposes faith. Normally, you should be able to say history, and you can have the history of science, or you can have the history of art, or you can have my mother's here, and you can have the history of dance. She spent her life teaching dance. So you could have the history of dance, you could have the history of English, you could have the history of any discipline. In fact, the history of the discipline is usually a component of the discipline if you study it at any length. And there is a history of Christianity as well. But there's a problem with Christianity's history. And that is that it presupposes faith, which is no good. Normally, you would not want history to presuppose faith. Right? Okay, I mean, we could talk about that modicum of faith, is what is really knowledge, and do we really know anything and all that. But I mean, Christianity presupposes a lot more faith than that. Why? When you just read Christian history, which is mainly the Synoptic Gospels, that's mainly where you find history. Why? Because the other part is somebody else's mail. Right? Most of the rest of the New Testament is somebody else's mail. I mean, we get to read it vicariously and learn lots. And we can reconstruct history behind it a little bit. And then we fight about that, and then we can spend entire careers fighting about it. It's fun. I recommend it. I've already sold Robert on it. But so we have to go to the Synoptic Gospels, and then you have a little bit of history. Of course, we can debate whether it's history or biography or whatever. But let's just say for a second that it's history. Why is it problematic? Because you have a lot of one-time events, right? Really, the theme of today's lecture, if it is a lecture, is sui generis. Too many things happen in the Synoptic Gospels that have only ever happened at one point in time. Never happened before and never happened later. So, why is this problematic? Well, it's like miraculous history or something. And those two things, it means that our history demands faith, which is like an oxymoron, right? Your history shouldn't demand faith. It should just be something that you can access, that you can learn, that you can understand about. These things happen. There can be various uncertainties. But we shouldn't have mainly uncertainties. And in the Synoptic Gospels, a Christian history is presented with almost all uncertainties. Why? What is the main type of uncertainty that you encounter?
The nature of Christ.
Yeah. That's what Doug said this morning. He's like, you're kind of doing the same lecture twice. I go, then you're talking about really different. What are you talking about? Because I did talk about the nature of the Christ last time. But what is it that Jesus does that we find a little bit, well, that's not us, but the scientists find like a little odd? One-off events, what are they called? Miracles, right? Jesus does miracles and one after the next. We're like, okay. And the scientists are like, this didn't happen, right? And then he does the miracle par excellence, which is the biggest problem, which is what? Resurrection from the dead. Now, not only has this never happened before and never happened after Jesus, which is basically problematic, it's a sui generis event, which is anti-historical in many respects, or anti-scientific, but also, we were talking about this morning, it's the greatest thing that could ever happen to humanity, right? It's the one thing that we would want more than anything else. So, that makes it seem a little bit like wishful thinking. So now you have this Christian history that presupposes faith, which is no good. Which means if it's a history that demands that you believe it, what is faith anyway? What does it mean that it's demanding our faith to accept this as history? What is faith? Let's say we have a spectrum from opinion to knowledge. Where's faith? Well, Thomas Aquinas wanted you to think that it was knowledge. And then there came some skeptics along, and they bounced it back to sort of partway between opinion and knowledge. It's kind of a kind of knowledge, but it's kind of your opinion as well. But where is it really, if we're honest? It's left of opinion, right? It really goes faith, that is miracles, one-offs, things that are never happened before and never happened afterward, which we claim happened. And then there's opinion, that's a lot of people agree with you, and you're not totally mad if you believe. And then knowledge, right? Things that still demand faith, but much, much, much less faith. So if you have a history that demands faith, you have a problem. How did this get constructed? The very way that we talked about last time, we were talking about the nature of the Christ. When the early Christians decided that they were going to construe Jesus as half divine and half human, they were looking for problems. Right around the corner was somebody going, what? Nobody else in the history of mankind has ever been half divine and half human. Why do you say that Jesus is so? Well, you could argue, and we talked about this a little bit last time, that Hercules was too, but the Greeks never thought Hercules was real, right? So it's different, because the Jews thought Jesus was real. So this is a truly a sui generis category. If you know of another one, let me know. Except the ones that came after Jesus, who all claim to be in his image. But you have a situation where a person was human and is divine, and you make the claim that he was the only one like that, and all we have to do is wait through the Middle Ages to the Reformation and the Enlightenment, where everyone says there is no way. That's not possible. Denis Diderot, famous French philosopher, once said, everybody in Paris can tell me that a man rose from the dead, and I will not believe them. In other words, what is the point there? I don't care what people say. Human testimony doesn't matter. Science and rationale and rational thinking demand, reason demand, that cannot happen. So it did not happen. And so you wonder why we're up against a little bit of skepticism now. Right? Why Christians face skepticism. Why? Because of this. Right? Because it's impossible. Because our history demands faith. That's ludicrous. Right? So, I want to take you just a little bit through. I mean, we could talk about this theme on lots of different topics, but I just want to talk about the topic of the historical Jesus and the direction that this took as one example. Sorry. For how this problem plays out. The name of the problem is the historical Jesus. What happened, and I'm grossly summarizing, which I felt much more comfortable about doing until David walked in, but now I'm grossly summarizing and I feel like I have to say so. No. So in the Enlightenment court, there was this emphasis on reason. The emphasis on reason was so strong that they even replaced statues of the Virgin Mary in Notre Dame Cathedral with Lady Liberty. Right, with images of Lady of Reason. Because reason was queen, would you say? This was all right in the Middle Ages. You know, when Christianity first got going, they devised these theories like Jesus is equal to God. And they were like going with that for a while. And then in the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas even said this is provable by like legal precepts, and so he made, you know, went to great lengths to create doctrines in vast theses and treatises that argue these points, that God exists and Jesus' relationship to God and God is creator and all of these things. And this was part of the institutionalization of the church, and it grew and grew and grew. But it was very fragile. And even in the Middle Ages, with people like Erasmus, and eventually, when Martin Luther started asking questions, and John Calvin and others like them in the Reformation, and then by the Enlightenment, when reason really came to dominate our approach to a knowledge, this toppled over. How did it affect actual thinking about the New Testament? Well, there are a couple of ways. And what happened is actually much later. A man named Albert Schweitzer summarized this for us, and now we really think in terms of Schweitzer's way of cataloging it. So I'm really talking from Schweitzer here, but I'm going to talk about how he cataloged these. There were two approaches. There was a romantic approach to the Synoptic Gospels, and there was a critical approach to the Synoptic Gospels. So some people said, Jesus, okay, he couldn't have done the miracles, so that's out. So he was a teacher. So he was a lovely teacher. He's so lovely, and he had lovely teachings. And they thought the teachings were innovative, sometimes even unique. They hadn't pushed it so far to show that they were actually all similar to Greek and Jewish culture. But so there was the most famous example of this is Ernst Renan. And he wrote in the beginning of the 19th century, and Schweitzer talks about Renan's approach to Jesus. He says, Renan offered his readers a Jesus who was alive, whom he, with his artistic imagination, that is Renan, had met under the blue heaven of Galilee, and whose lineaments his inspired pencil had seized. And it's true, if you read Renan's, gorgeous. You just feel like you're walking through, you know, over the hills of Galilee, and Jesus breathes the Sermon on the Mount, and you are inspired. So he talks, I won't read the whole quotation there, but Renan's approach was, we can salvage something of Jesus in this age of reason by accepting that he's a philosophical teacher guy. Now, there were other approaches, and the most famous is the approach of Hermann Samuel Reimarus, who wrote documents about the Synoptic Gospels, and he didn't publish them because he knew that he wouldn't live as long as he did if he had published them. But he subjected the Synoptic Gospels to a historical critical investigation, one of the first. And later, these were published by a man named Lessing under the title The Wolfenbüttel Fragments. And these essentially argued that the miracles should be rejected and that the authors of the Synoptic Gospels are guilty of fraud. But this is not possible. This is later spun slightly differently by a very well-known New Testament scholar named Adolf von Harnack, who said, well, it's fraud, but really what it was appropriation of Jewish traditions on Greek terms. So Jesus is told as a God incarnate. Well, this is standard Greek theology. So he said, you know, if you could go through the New Testament and get rid of all the Greek trappings, you would have this earthy, original Jewish Jesus. And actually, that's not far from where many people remain today. Reimarus then inspired an entire school in some ways. And the school, I'm again summarizing quickly, but was in Tübingen, Germany. And it's still kind of considered the mecca of historical critical approaches to the New Testament, although they're not really so much anymore. If you really know the faculty of the New Testament, they're nice, but not quite critical as they were. I was there a year ago in April. I had tea with Martin Hingel, who now died, passed away, but so it was still sort of there when he was there. But I asked some of the current faculty and younger faculty where you would find the grave sites of these great critical luminaries. You know, and they're like, not exactly sure. This is proof that you've lost your edge, you know. The edge is Chicago, I think. But in any case, so there was a person named David Friedrich Strauss. And he, too, picked up on what Reimarus was saying, and said that he didn't say that the evangelists were guilty of fraud, but he said that the miracles could all be explained as acts of nature. And it wasn't quite as we thought. And Strauss then inspired F.C. Bauer. Sorry, I have this printed as a PowerPoint for my students, so we have a map of Germany and all kinds of good things that you don't need today. Ferdinand Christian Bauer is today still one of my heroes, and it was actually that grave I would have liked to see most. And he's famous for this critical approach to the New Testament in the 19th century. Taking apart the New Testament Gospels and attempting to ascertain what was really true about the historical Jesus and what had to be layers of tradition. Remember, if Jesus spoke Aramaic, taking it back to like sort of the simplest level, if Jesus spoke Aramaic, then our texts are in Greek right there. We have a problem. Right? And so this is a famous problem about the Lord's Prayer, that one of the words in Greek, epiusin, really doesn't go back into Aramaic. When we have a word, that word is daily, like our daily, from our daily bread. And what that word is in Greek and how it really goes back is problematic. And if you can't retranslate it, then who made this prayer up in what language? Well, of course, then all the critics come out, I mean, all the pious come out and say, oh, well, you know, we spoke Greek too, and, you know, Americans are like, people speak one language. and the Swiss are like, Jesus easily spoke three, you know. So we're not exactly sure. But it's unlikely, probably, that Jesus would have delivered this prayer in Greek, which then becomes problematic. So Bauer was critical. He was not as critical as we are today because he still kind of believed in effect, right? After postmodernism, we sort of say there's no such thing as effect, right? Nothing flies in from Mars and lands on Earth and we go, that is true. We kind of realize that they're all our own stories. The problem with postmodernism for me is all of our own stories, well, they coincide to a great degree, right? I'd like to think I'm really unique, but Meredith and I share many beliefs in common, so those are working facts, right? Although we're sophisticated and we know they're not really facts, they're working facts. There were others like F.C. Bauer. There was a man named William Bredeth. First name is English, second name's German. I'm always tempted to say Wilhelm. He went by William, evidently. But he questioned the historical reliability of the Gospel of Mark and is very famous for his thesis on that at Göttingen. All right, so as I mentioned earlier, there was a romantic approach and there was a critical approach. And then Schweitzer came along and said, whoa, you know what? What if I cataloged all these approaches? Cataloging taxonomy is always a good idea. You learn a ton by cataloging things. So this is what he did. And he did this enormous service. Schweitzer's book is here. It's called The Quest of the Historical Jesus, although today we call it The Quest for the Historical Jesus because Americans switched the preposition and no one really knows when or why or how, but that's how it is. The Quest of the Historical Jesus is, just as I said, it's a catalog of how there were these, they called them lives, the romantic lives, like Renan's, and then there were these critical lives of Jesus. And, I mean, Schweitzer made a number of different observations. One thing he noticed is that the life of Jesus, the figure of Jesus in that life, resembles the author of the life. So that seems maybe kind of obvious to us, but even the people that attempted to take a very scientific approach to the data, that is the Gospels, were crunching the data in a way like not realizing their own presuppositions were guiding the way that the data is processed, and they were coming up with a Jesus who looked awfully like themselves. And in fact, this is still the case today. So you want an easy article, you want an easy review, get a new treatment of the historical Jesus. You can find them on the shelf all of the time. Grab it and then take a look at the Jesus that comes out of that approach and also take a look at the life of the author. You'll usually find a correspondence. You can write a review saying, oh, isn't it funny how John Dominic Crossan's Jesus is a social activist and so is he. Escaping this problem might sound easy. It's not so easy. Even hardcore scientists like me have found it very difficult. And I think, you know, I have some admiration, and I'll talk a little bit if I get a chance about what the scientific approach to the data is. And it's fairly respectable. Scientists today, or historians of the New Testament, are making a concerted effort to objectively weigh the data in the New Testament, and they're still coming up with a Jesus that looks awfully like themselves. So I don't want to be caught in that bind, so I'm not writing one until I can figure out another angle. And if you can figure out another angle, I'm open to it. So Schweitzer, this is what his book did, but his book also did something else. His book said that the real problem with the New Testament is not that Jesus was a romantic teacher, or that we can critically say that the miracles didn't happen. Schweitzer was kind of over all of that. Okay, you know, now we kind of get the thing that the miracles are a problem and you believe them or you don't, whatever. And he also realized that if we don't have the miracles, we don't have much else. And he was also starting to realize that the teachings had much in common with other teachings of the period and from the Hebrew Bible and elsewhere. But he had another really very serious problem that he's famous for. And this is that Jesus' teaching, his central teaching, as Schweitzer saw it, was eschatology. And that this message, that the end of the world was coming, never happened. So he has this great, I don't know the exact history of this, and I didn't have time to brush up on it beforehand, but he has this in an earlier version of this Quest of the Historical Jesus, which this is a reprint of the second edition, I think in the first edition, At the end of the book, it says, and so, and I'm going to misquote, this is a bad paraphrase, but something about how this great wheel of history turns and turns and turns until it crushes its savior, or something about how Jesus didn't outlast the final criticism, which is that he argued that the end of the world was going to come and it didn't happen. And you know, prophets, what does their accuracy need to be for them to be considered prophets? You all were checked with again, prophets, period. 100% right. You can't have like, oh, sorry, missed that one. Thought the end of the world was coming, but, oh, I meant later, right? Or, you know, in fact, this happens with millenarian movements all the time. There was those guys who wore those big white cowboy hats, gigantic white cowboy hats. I think they were Koreans in Texas.
Texas.
They predicted that this was not in Illinois. I just want to say, not in Illinois and not in California. Any other places represented? Okay. So, but anyway, they thought they had these huge 50-gallon hats or whatever, so that then when the Spirit came, they would get more Spirit. I mean, it's good thinking, don't you think? All right, anyway, so they were going to get more Spirit. And they predicted it was at 10 o'clock in July something. This is 1997, I think, because a couple of my friends took a road trip out there and were there for it. And 10 o'clock hit, the news reporters were there. This is all true. And nothing. I know, it's no surprise to you guys, but there was nothing. And so the news reporter goes to the head guy. Okay, so what happened? And you know what he said? This is brilliant. This is brilliant for thinking about the New Testament and about Jesus' eschatological message. What did he say? You didn't see it?
Miscalculation.
He goes, you didn't see it?
Oh.
And then they go, no, no, we didn't. And he goes, no kidding. I saw it with my third eye. And they were like, I did too, see ya. I am out of here now. Time for a drive-through and back to Illinois. Yeah, so then there's this postponement, and this happens in early Christianity because they're a little bit worried, right? John the Baptist and Jesus and Paul all say the end is coming, and it doesn't come. Or, I don't know, you saw it and I didn't, or something. So there's this spiritualization of this problem. Well, Schweitzer says, no, this wheel crushed Jesus. That's it. That's the end of the story in his first version, then he modifies it. And, this began what's known as the quest of the historical Jesus, or the quest of the historical Jesus, which now has three phases. Okay, this is getting kind of academic and boring, but there are three phases of the quest of the historical Jesus. And the first one is this Schweitzer one, where he said, you know, bottom line is, you thought miracles were a problem? No. That's not near as much a problem as the eschatological message, which ruins the whole thing, so goodbye. So now you wonder why it's a little bit difficult to attract people to Christianity today? They have some sense of these issues, especially in Hyde Park. So, plotting happens, and there are people like Rudolf Bultmann who are still saying, well, then what is the New Testament? Well, let's open it like a book. You know, this whole fiction approach is fiction, which has actually learned a tremendous amount about the texts in these literary so-called approaches, which I'm very grateful for, and I think that the historical critical method is gaining steam at this time, and they're sorting out how can we splice the New Testament, what can we learn? Are there any traditions, you know, Bultmann was very interested in, forget Jesus, but are there any traditions that go back near Jesus? Or are they all like 85 or 125? Is there anything like 55? Like, how far back could we go? Until the 1950s, when another one of my heroes, Ernst Käsemann, also in Tübingen. I tell you, they were good for a long while, but not so much today. Ernst Käsemann said, what? No. Too skeptical. This has all gone too skeptical. I mean, there was a point at which Martin Kaler says, well, Rudolf Bultmann says, look, all we need is that Jesus existed. He's like, I'll give you everything. Throw out the New Testament. I just need that he existed. And it was a famous theory. You guys know what it's called. Das Das. Das Das means the that. What's the that? That Jesus existed. So I can have Christian faith if I can be guaranteed that Jesus ever existed. Because if you're going to tell me that he never even existed, then I'm out. I'm Buddhist. Right? I'm going somewhere else. And Martin Kaler said, oh, Bultmann, cheer up. You don't need that. We don't even need to know that he existed. And I ask my students this all the time. He said, do you think Christian churches would close if we knew for a fact today that Jesus never existed? And my students all go, nope, they keep going. And my students are probably right. And Martin Kaler is the one one who had this idea. We really don't need to know that Jesus existed, is what some people say. So now you're saying faith and history? It's a major problem. You see this? History is in the garbage by the middle of the 20th century. Christian history is gone. And it's all faith, such that Martin Kaler can say, just believe. Believe in, I don't know, God and the idea of Jesus that sprung out of the first century based on no human being. And Bultmann's like, just one human being called Jesus and I'm okay, right? And this is when Ernst Cajeman said, you are crackers. All of you people have lost it. We have, even the classicists are not this critical, right? He said, come on, we have an ancient text. We all think it's an ancient text. Okay, we don't know if it's 50 or 100, but let's just say it's 50 to 100. Is that bad? So there's still some early Christians. They're still doing some thinking and talking and creating theological dicta and so forth that we have here. So what are they? So Cajeman just argued, let's back it up. We'd not throw the New Testament in the garbage. Because if we do, somebody else will take it. It is valuable. Just have to qualify in what way is it valuable. Cajeman was the main proponent of what ended up being called the New Quest. So there was Schweitzer's quest of the historical Jesus, and then there was Cajeman's. And he went back to the New Testament and started saying, well, look, okay, we can't really, I mean, Schweitzer, one thing that, I mean, Cajeman, one thing he couldn't throw away was Schweitzer. So he's like, okay, but we still have that eschatological problem, but that's okay, he was an eschatological prophet, and that's still something, right? And maybe he was a little off, or we need to reinterpret how the message actually came true, and maybe that's okay too. Maybe that could have its own existential reality or whatever. And you know what? Frankly, this is exactly what the Gospel of John is doing. So it's doing long, it's doing this, Christianity is doing this long before Cajeman. But so Cajeman was largely right, and an absolute genius. And when I first got to the University of Chicago, I was studying with Hans-Dieter Betz, and he had been a friend of Cajeman's, and I remember one time I was dropping off books at Betz's house, and he said to me, oh, look, a letter from Cajeman. I was like, slaying, like, can I see it? What does it say, you know? How's the wife? Or whatever. I was like, I don't care, I want to see a letter from Cajeman. So yeah, he accepted that apocalypticism was a problem, but he didn't think that the whole New Testament needed to be discarded because of it. So history was radically qualified, but not totally trashed. And then in the 60s and following, we moved into, well, I mean, in retrospect, we moved into what's now called the Third Quest, which is a new approach to the text that is, it's kind of on board with Cajeman, not totally throwing in the garbage, but attempting scientifically, am I at, like, how much time do I have, Robert? Because, you know, I'll just go on forever.
About 6-7 more minutes and then...
Okay, so if I took the time for questions, no, okay. So it's a quasi-scientific approach. And for the humanities, I think it's pretty good. And exemplar, there's John Dominic Crossan, and there is Marcus Borg, and some of these people that you may have read. And the main theme that you find is the only Jesus that we can say is the historical Jesus, given the Enlightenment, given everything we know, given the miracles, given the apocalyptic message, all we can really say is he's got to be Jewish. So the Jesus that we search for and find better be Jewish, or no, thank you. You're too quick of a review. We're probably not even going to get reviewed. So the theme there is, and you'll find this now, Jesus wasn't a peasant. Or some people, Jesus was actually... sophisticated intellectual. Jesus was a philosopher. You know, Hans-Dieter Betz can never resist. He's kind of, Jesus has more of a sophisticated philosophical edge, or air, would you say, for Hans-Dieter Betz. That's kind of where we are now. Now, there's a very famous group that was an infamous part of this Third Quest, and they were known as the Jesus Seminar, and you may have heard of them. And we can laugh in their general direction, but they, you know, do things that actually a lot of historical critics are doing underneath their bed at night as well. So, might as well take them for a minute. They were convened in 1985 by a man named Robert Funk. And there's bad jokes about him, like when he passed away, that they wanted to transplant his heart because it was in good condition, and then they found none. But anyway, it's not true. I'm sure he was a nice guy. And he was mostly, here's the problem, is that the Jesus Seminar was mostly interested in PR. That's the bottom line. Robert Funk wanted to be in the New York Times, and he was. So So that was the kind of like unfortunate side of it. Now the good side is that they, at least they have something to teach us today about kind of how scientists of Jesus go about figuring out who he was. And they have certain pillars of faith, and I'm just going to tell you what those are, and we get a little bit closer to figuring out how you go through the New Testament today as a scientist and say Jesus did this and Jesus didn't do that or whatever. And getting back to the theme of, well, what do we do with a history that demands our faith? They distinguished between Jesus and Christ. Christ was the person you believed in once he died, if you bought into the whole Greek, you know, cult of the dead or whatever. And Jesus was the man, the person that we're searching for, which is why we have this constant return to the idea of the historic Jesus. The Synoptic Gospels are historically more accurate than John. That's just one of the beliefs. All of the 200 whatever well-known scholars, a lot of the people that Funk said were in his group, never claimed to be in his group, never signed the memo or whatever. They clicked on his website, and next thing you know, they were a member. Mark and priority, that Mark was the earliest gospel. Acceptance of Q, they believed that that Matthew and Luke both had access to a second, at least, document that they both used in writing their gospels. They rejected the apocalyptic Jesus, different from Schweitzer, and they argued that the eschatological thing had been added later, so any eschatological sayings could be deferred, which is kind of new. They distinguished between oral and written culture, so when you could tell that something, so when you have a memorizable saying, that could go back to Jesus. If you have a narrative, Jesus walked down the street and he saw a couple people and he said hello, then he kicked a stone, and then he said, the Son of Man for the Sabbath, not the Sabbath for the Son of Man. The saying is a memorizable unit that could have been retained through oral history, whereas the narrative before it had to be made up. So that could not be sort of original. So they distinguished that in that way. And then they also reversed the burden of proof on those who consider the gospel content to be historical. And they said, we're going to presuppose the New Testament is not historical. And we're going to allow the New Testament to prove to us on certain occasions that it might be historical. And then, does anybody know how they went about figuring out what was actually Jesus and what wasn't? Yeah, they voted by beads. And I got my own version. So then they published this version of the New Testament called the Five Gospels, because they include the Gospel of Thomas, because they thought there was a chance that it might be as early as the Synoptics, which is probably not the case. But anyway, they didn't give it short shrift, which I think is okay. Anyway, and then they published this, and the red saying, no, how did it work again? The black sayings were Jesus. Let me see. The color of the bead represented the authenticity. Red beads was some, okay, so black was, red beads indicated the voter believed Jesus said the passage or quoted it. Pink was that Jesus probably said something like it. Gray was that he did not say it. And black was that this clearly from tradition. I got my copy of this book by Robert Funk, Five Gospels, on sale because all the colors are mixed up, which is probably why I have this color problem with them. Because like mine are magenta and pink and green or something like that. But anyway, it was worth whatever the $7 I paid for it. They give explanations of how the group decided. So they summarize the majority view. And you can imagine, as you flip through, if the sayings of Jesus are in red, if you flipped through the book, which would be nice if I brought it, but I didn't, how many would be red, should be red? How many would you imagine they voted were red?
Very,
very few, yeah. And how many are black? Yeah, and then I have a couple that are like magenta. But most of them are black. Authentic sayings included, turn the other cheek. The Matthew 5:40 about if you give your coat, give your tunic as well. And one of the things that the Jesus Seminar did that got them a lot of attention is their translations from the Greek are hip. So they're not David Martinez style. They're like really edgy. So one of the sayings that they think was authentic was, and David will like this, congratulations, poor. So in front of the Sermon on the Mount, right? Congratulations, poor. I love that one. Go the second mile, love your enemies, leaven, the argument about leaven, the statement about and the emperor and God, giving to beggars, the Good Samaritan. Here's another good one. Congrats,
hungry. Congrats, sad. So we say, blessed are those who mourn, but they said, congrats, sad. Shrewd manager, vineyard and the laborers, Abba Father, and the mustard seed were all taken to be authentic, but everything else not. Nothing, I think there's nothing in the Gospel of John that's authentic, that's a saying. They did also rate the acts of Jesus. And I'll close with this. Jesus was born during the reign of Herod. His mother's name was Mary, and he had a human father whose name may or may not have been Joseph. Jesus was born in Nazareth, not in Bethlehem. Jesus was an itinerant sage who shared meals with social outcasts. Jesus practiced healing without the use of ancient medicine or magic, relieving afflictions we now consider psychosomatic. That's brutal. That is brutal, right? Okay, who are they to say? All right, but still, there are some problems. Like, they've now discovered that there are ways to jog the retina, and then you can see again, and so they're claiming this is what Jesus actually did. All right, whatever. It takes away from the whole story. The story's clearly a magic story, right? It's clearly a miracle story, so just, like, leave it like that and throw it away as is, but psychosomatic. He did not walk on water, feed the multitude with loaves and fishes, change water into wine, or raise Lazarus from the dead. He was arrested in Jerusalem and crucified by the Romans. He was executed as a public nuisance, not for claiming to be the Son of God. The empty tomb is a fiction. Jesus was not raised bodily from the dead. And then note that the empty tomb also accreted new traditions that are also all hogwash. Risen from the dead, appeared, reappeared, and promised to return. That's just all like, you know, concatenation of bad ideas that one after led to the next. And then the belief in the resurrection, they argue on the positive side, was based on the visionary experiences of Peter, mainly, also Paul, and also probably Mary Magdalene. So that's kind of where it is today. I mean, if you wonder how you run the basis of the skepticism that you might run into in terms of Christian faith, it's very warranted. It's very, very warranted. Christian faith, there are lots and lots of problems. And I just want to close on this more positive note, which is I think
Paul knew this. I think everybody after Paul, like, tried to create this whole thing where it really makes sense, and John Mullenhallen knows that I'm going to say this because I close with this every time I talk about this subject. But yeah, I think Paul knew this when he said in 1 Corinthians, and I can quote it rather than paraphrasing it poorly, like what I've done most of the rest of the half hour. So he says, for the message about the cross, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, for the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. So he's saying, the world gets this as foolishness, right? Which is exactly what this lecture just tried to show. It only lasted until the Enlightenment, which is actually rather a long time, before people went, the house was the three pigs' first house. It basically blew over on its own. Come on, one person in history is human and divine? You're fine to argue that if you argue it on the basis of faith, but if you're going to try to say that it's not, that you're going to run into some problems. And they ran into some problems. So back to the text. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. So he borrows from the Hebrew Bible in a different context to make his point. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since, in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided, through the foolishness of our proclamation, to save those who believe. Now, you can say that was a very good rhetorical argument, which it is. But still, this is, I think, Paul, if you take this to be remotely genuine, then I think Paul foresaw all of this, right? Our whole institutionalization of the church, Paul was like, probably going, because you know what? Some smart person's going to walk along and go, is not logical, cannot withstand logical arguments. Better to go, I understand this, as God's plan to present foolishness as wisdom. And he even says, you know, God tried wisdom. What'd they do? They didn't believe me. So now he's going the foolishness route.